Hello, everyone. I'm Lisa Godley in for Barbara Hambley. It's the first American drama to air on PBS in more than a decade. It's called Mercy Street, and it debuts on WHRO TV 15 this coming Sunday. It's a Civil War-based drama that follows the lives of two volunteer nurses on opposing sides of the war. Up next on Another View on Health, we'll talk about medicine and healthcare during this time of strife. It's a new twist to our AV on Health shows, the history of medicine during the Civil War. Stay tuned. Another View is up next, right after this news from NPR.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Lisa Godley in for Barbara Hambley. Please keep Barbara and her family in your thoughts and prayers. Barbara lost her father this week, Charles Osborne Ham, who, along with his lovely wife of 59 years, raised two beautiful daughters, our Barbara. After suffering a brief illness, he passed away this week at the age of 54. He was a wonderful man who will truly be missed. And Barbara, we are 80. Did I say 54? 84. I'm sorry. He's at the age of 84. Barbara, we are sending you and your family much love. Now, we're going to do something a little different for today's Another View on Health, because we're talking about the history of medicine. In this case, medicine during the Civil War. A brand new six-part drama called Mercy Street will debut on PBS and WHRO TV 15 this Sunday at 10 p.m. It's the story of what happened at a Union Army hospital called Mansion House, which was located in Alexandria, Virginia. Inspired by memoirs and letters from real doctors and nurse volunteers, Mercy Street reveals the stories of those struggling to save lives and at the same time managing their own hardships. So on this edition of Another View on Health, we are looking at medicine through the lens of history. Let's welcome our guest, our favorite historian, Norfolk State University professor, Dr. Cassandra Newby Alexander. Welcome.
Thank you.
Audrey Davis is joining us on the phone. She is the director of the Alexandria Black History Museum and was a consultant for Mercy Street. Audrey, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And of course, Another View on Health co-host, cardiologist Dr. Keith Newby.
How are you?
I am good. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Good. Before we get started, since this focuses on Mercy Street and this all stems from Mercy Street, let's listen to a clip from the television drama, and it starts with the head nurse speaking to a free black who is working in the hospital at the time.
Ooh, my arm!
What is it?
I feel my blood. It's running dry.
Where are the doctors?
No one left but Dr. Foster. He's got a patient in surgery.
I'll send for someone else.
Hemorrhage. Brachial artery.
I'll go myself fast.
You need to stay.
Oh, make it stop, please.
This man can't wait.
Forgive me, Lord. Forgive me.
Give me some thread.
Samuel, we can't.
Thread. I need more light. When they removed the bullet, the blood vessel got ruptured. They cauterized over it. It's infected now. He'll bleed to death.
Oh, no. They're killing his mother, please.
No, I can't let you do this. We need someone who knows how.
I know how, Nurse Mary. I know how. This boy gets saved by a negro or he dies alone.
My arm!
He needs chloroform.
You need to dampen the cloth and place it over his mouth. Help hold the wound open.
Blood makes me uneasy.
You'll need to overcome that. There's the rupture. Now pinch the artery for me. I'll tie a loop around it. Leave an end dangling out. That way a doctor can pull it a little every day until the thread rots off and the rupture is closed. If they don't know how, you gotta tell them. It's called a ligature.
How will we know if it worked?
It'll work. I've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Finney. What happened here?
He was in grave pain. The wound was hemorrhaging, so...
Who tied this ligature?
I did. Miss Dix trained me how.
Miss Dix? And who trained her? Every day we'll need to...
Pull on the end until the thread rots and the rupture closes.
Got a patient on the table.
Dr. Barrison taught me things when I was little. Ever since, I just kept on learning.
Wow, it's very, very compelling. I started watching the drama and I just could not look away. Audrey, I am going to start with you since you worked as a historic consultant on the drama. Tell us a little bit about your role in that.
Well, one of the things that my role focused on was the story of African-American life in Alexandria. I had the privilege of working with one of the researchers, Lisa Goodfellow-Bowe. Early on in the process, she contacted the museum to find out what resources we had and people in the area that she should talk to. And so we worked, I sent emails back and forth for a period of time, and then at a certain point she asked if I would consider reviewing the scripts that they had for the first season to advise on things that, just to make sure that what they were telling, and because they really are trying to be as historically accurate as possible, would reflect what was going on in Alexandria for African Americans.
Okay, all righty. Keith? I'm watching the drama and I'm watching people just laying out, and they didn't have a lot back then to work with.
Yeah, a lot of, as you probably could gather, you know, the how things were done then compared to how things are done now is like night and day. And I think one of the things I think was important, it's unfortunate that a lot of people lost their lives as a result of this learning curve, but I think as the Civil War progressed into today's times, you learn as you move forward and you start to see the errors of your ways. We started to develop things better. We started to learn about bacteriology and, you know, how infection, because if you look at the historical accuracy, and Sandy, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but then people died more not from battle wounds, but from the aftermath of whatever they had done, because there was such, the sterile technique was non-existent back then. I mean, they just cut and run. You talk about these limbs piling up as they just cut and throw things, and they wipe, you know, the utensils on their clothes. And I mean, there was no gloves being used. I mean, it was just a total free for all. So really, a lot of the infections were just getting passed on from person to person. And a lot of people died from that, not from the actual battle wounds themselves, but how they cared for it. So they had to really go through this process of learning. Now, there were some, you know, pioneers that really kind of helped to change some things with how they started off one way and ended another way. And if you look at it, the Union was actually probably the leader of a lot of that. And they were the ones that had the better hospitals and had more physicians and really more just healthcare providers. When you look at, I think it was almost like a 3-to-1 ratio with the North and the South in terms of medical personnel. So the South really didn't have a whole lot, and they were really trying to, you know, I heard they were pillaging stuff from the North and, you know, supplies and things, trying to, you know, I guess keep their soldiers alive as well. So it was a lot of just free-for-all medicine that, you know, we would just cringe if we even saw some of the things, you know, because I know anytime I see that, I say, there's no way that could have been the way they did it back then, but it was the way they did it back then.
Yeah, because every time you hear the word gangrene, yeah, you see somebody coming with a saw.
Yeah.
So this day and time, I guess it would, the idea is to never let it get to that point.
Yeah. Well, gangrene itself is a bacteria that comes usually from poor blood flow. So when you hear like that term when they were talking about the blood loss, a lot of those people did. I mean, they didn't know how to, you know, really suture a lot of these wounds. And it was, you know, understanding how you had to, when you did amputate, you know, how you took care of the wound. Wound care, again, was non-existent. So a lot of things would happen as a result. If you're not caring for the wound correctly, it's going to get infected. It just will. I mean, fortunately, when the good Lord put us all together, he put them safety mechanisms in, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was like 7% of people did survive in terms of who went through some things, but that was our body's natural response, and you know, the antibodies we create that helped do it. It wasn't the people that was doing the work. It was the individuals' bodies recovering from whatever, you know, was going on. It was just some people were just lucky enough to survive, and some weren't.
And I noticed a lot of the workers seemed to be volunteers that didn't really have medical training.
That's the part that gets to you when you read that and you see that, is that a lot of these people were not. I mean, because back then, I mean, they said that Harvard Medical School didn't even own the stethoscope until after the Civil War.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, just I'm sitting there trying to think how and where did they train anybody. But, you know, then it was like 2 years of medical school and that was it. You know, now, you know, you have, you know, for my training, it was, you know, college, medical school, residency, fellowship. And then, you know, I became a cardiologist. But then it was like 2 years of medical school and that was it. So you probably learned a year. You went out, you know, they say they do one, see one, teach one. I mean, see one, do one, teach one. It was really like that. So, you know, and when you're really thinking about it, that's when I think that trial and error thing came into play, because people would do stuff and they say, oh, okay, yeah, I guess this turned out okay, so I keep doing it that way. Or, man, no, I guess he's crap out of luck. I guess, you know, it didn't work that way on that one, so I guess I got to try another way the next time. So there was a lot of the training, the whole, I mean, there was really no procedure. I mean, you know, how things were done. You may do one thing one way one time, next day you'll do it a different way. I mean, they just hadn't developed methodology of how to do procedures, you know, how you do surgery, you know, exactly what were you looking for? How were you trying to, you know, to get to that end stage, which is to get the person better? There was just a free-for-all.
Okay. Cassandra, I did see some nurses. I didn't see any African-American nurses.
No, I was actually disappointed that the series did not include any Black nurses, but at the same time, since the focus of attention was on the Mansion House and not on the Contraband Hospital, which was located a few streets over, most of the Black nurses only worked with Black patients. They worked alongside the Black troops. They worked in camp hospitals. This took place in Alexandria. And of course, as bad as the situation was in Alexandria, multiply that probably by 10, and that's what it was on the fields. And so if they ran out of supplies in our major city, imagine how primitive the conditions were in other places. In addition to that, the clip that you broadcast, Dorothea Dix, there was a mention of a Dix. She was the first woman, of course, designated as the superintendent for nurses. And so she was laying the groundwork for this upcoming new professional group of women, many of whom had been teachers, some of them simply middle class, knew how to read and write, wanted to contribute something. Most of them were initially volunteers. Eventually, they were paid. But for Black nurses, most of them were not paid. They were not even regarded as nurses, and they were not included in the statistics of 3,000 nurses that served during the Civil War. So we have really no idea how many nurses were actually serving.
Okay. Audrey, tell us a little bit about what was going on with the contrabands during that particular time.
Oh, sure. And I just wanted to piggyback on something that Cassandra was saying, too.
Okay.
And Dr. Newby as well, that the one of the issues, too, that you're seeing the nurses face is this new profession, really, of nursing, and how it was not considered appropriate in some cases for women to be nurses because of the fact that they were seeing these wounded men and that they were seeing these men in states of undress. And so you'll see that as the story moves forward about not only the racism in the show that African-Americans face, but also the sexism. And we did have 5 or 6 African-American nurses in our contraband hospital over on Washington Street and also at our Louverture Hospital. But like Cassandra was saying, they were not always paid, and some of them may have been former teachers and came to this as volunteers, but they not only faced racism, but also sexism. And the character that you saw in this first scene is Sam, who is a free black character in Alexandria. And there will be three main characters this season on Mercy Street: Sam, a free black; Aurelia, a contraband, who fled to Alexandria from North Carolina seeking freedom; and Belinda, who is a slave, a former slave of the Green family, who has stayed out of loyalty but is now looking at her new life as a free person. So you will see these stories throughout the first season of Mercy Street.
Okay. The fact that you mentioned Aurelia, I did get to speak to yesterday Shalita Grant, who plays Aurelia in the drama, and let's go to her interview.
We all could use a hand now and again.
We? Who we? You from some fancy house in Philadelphia? You in school? Dressing fine clothes, never beating of a soul? Ain't that right, Mr. Diggs? Where I come from? Seen things, heard things, done some things. Ain't no we, thank you.
Shalita, thank you so much for joining us. Tell me a little bit about your character in Mercy Street.
I play Aurelia Johnson, who is an ex-slave laundress. She has manumitted herself. She set herself free. We're in the middle of the Civil War, and she has escaped further north in Virginia to Alexandria, which is now a Union city. And she gets a job at the Mercy Street, the Mansion House Hospital, as a laundress. And she's waiting to be reunited with some really important family members. And she asks her boss, Silas Bullen, for help in making that happen. And you see her story unfold from there.
How did you prepare for the role of a slave who had escaped slavery?
Being a black woman, my family was really strong about us learning our history. And so I, you know, I've lived with, you know, slavery and the Civil War and Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement, you know, since I was a little girl. And then being from Virginia, I remember coloring in pictures of Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee with titles like Gentlemen of the South. Virginia is very proud of their Confederate history and one of three states in the Union that celebrates Confederate History Month. You know, my background with this period, being from Virginia and then moving to New York, I went to Juilliard for college. Being at such a prestigious conservatory and then, you know, going into theater, I was usually the only black face in white spaces. And that says a lot to you. But in order to be successful as a black person and you're, you know, traversing these, you know, minefields, you kind of have to live in a state of denial, you know, that you are the only in the room. And, you know, in order to keep your wits about you. But when I got this part, I had to start whittling away at that defense, that denial that about where we are in this country right now, and that it doesn't feel very different from, you know, Aurelia's circumstance. And one of my personal points of similarity is Aurelia is in this pivotal place in her life and in the country where half of the country is saying that black people need to be set free in order to, for the country to survive. And the other half is saying, no, they need to continue to be enslaved for, you know, our country to survive. And so black people are at the center of the conversation for the first time in a very long time. You know, we have the conversation about the three-fifths, but now it's a conversation about our freedom. And so she has taken her life into her own hands and said, I'm going to set myself free and I'm going to have the life that I want to have. And then she gets to Alexandria and she gets this rude awakening that it's just business as usual. And my personal similar instance is 2008 when Barack Obama was elected to presidency. We've had 43 white presidents. And for the first time, we have a black president, and I voted, and I was at Juilliard, and I remember walking from the dorm at Juilliard to the Juilliard school, like a weight was lifted off my shoulders, and I didn't know I had a weight to begin with. And I remember thinking, wow, I was not bred for this conservatory, but here I am. I made it. We have Oprah, Beyonce's thing, you know, now we have a black president. And so maybe it's true. Maybe racism is dying. Maybe, you know, so much hope. And then 8 years later, I can see black women and men being gunned down in the streets just by going onto YouTube.
What would you say was your favorite scene to shoot?
You know, my favorite scene to shoot was, it's a complex one. So there is a scene, I think it's like the third episode, where she meets, Aurelia meets a young slave boy. And the advice that she gives him is so antithetical to the life that she's leading. And she gets kind of frustrated with him that he doesn't take her advice. And I don't want to give too much away, but that was one of my favorite scenes, because Aurelia is still in that denial that her circumstance isn't what it is.
Is there anything in particular you're hoping people will get from watching?
Honestly, when I took the job, you know, I didn't know, first of all, that it was being marketed as a medical drama. And, you know, it's hard to mine anything in that period and not deal with racism and not see the echoes of, you know, just sort of the origin of where we are now. It's hard not to draw those lines. And so one of the things that stuck out to me was, what happens when you advise someone to stay out of it? And it's Mary's journey throughout this whole thing, is that she is this moral compass, and she's saying, like, hey, you know, this is wrong. And I thought, this is what we're fighting for. And her disillusionment, too, about what the war is about and what it means to be on the Union side, like what that truly means for people.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you. All right. Have a good rest of your day.
Okay, you too.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
Audrey, before we went to that piece, we were I was asking you about the contraband and the role back during that time. What were we seeing at that time?
What you'll be seeing in Mercy Street?
Yes.
Yes. You'll see the journey that Ms. Grant refers to for her character, and you'll see other contraband within the show, and you'll see what it was like for them in Alexandria, that many of them are fleeing to Alexandria from other places, seeking asylum, hoping that they'll have a chance to be free, hoping that the war will go for the Union and that they will, in fact, be really free. And in Alexandria, we have a huge influx of contraband coming into the city, which over time creates a humanitarian crisis in our city, because we don't have adequate shelter, food, clothing, jobs for the contraband that are coming in. And, of course, being a slave anyway, you're not the healthiest person, and you've traveled long distances, you're in a weakened condition. So we see many contraband dying here in Alexandria at a great rate, and many are buried initially in paupers' graves, and we don't have records of how many people were dying during that time, but we do hear accounts from others who are in the city about the horrible state of affairs for the contraband. But then in 1864, we do have the military establish a contraband burial ground, and we have now in Alexandria dedicated a memorial to those contraband who came to Alexandria seeking freedom but did not live long in freedom. And it's the burial ground of close to 2,000 African-American men, women, and children who died in Alexandria during the course of the war. And unfortunately, many of those burials were children under the age of 16.
Wow. Okay. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the history of medicine during the Civil War as a prelude to the new PBS drama, Mercy Street, with historian Dr. Cassandra Newby Alexander, Audrey Davis, the director of the Alexandria Black History Museum, and Avion Health co-host, Dr. Keith Newby.
You know, I wanted to piggyback on what Audrey was saying about the contraband camps. Most people don't know that between 10 and 100 people died in those camps per week. And if you look at the total population of those who died, it's estimated that 600,000 people died during the Civil War. 600,000 people died. We're not talking about participating. Died during the Civil War, with the overwhelming majority dying from dysentery, smallpox, lack of food, perhaps infections from wounds, as opposed to actual gunfire.
What was bringing about the dysentery? I often hear about that in relation to the Civil War and that particular time period. What was
closed spaces and poor sanitation? Because really, you know, when you think about dysentery, is, you know, so you talk about diarrhea, stomach viruses. So if you're expelling, you're not washing your hands, you know, you're around in close encounters with other people, it's very easy for that bacteria to get from one person to the next. You know, you think about it, again, if you take your food, you grabbing things and you put your hands on something, that, I mean, really brings new light to, you know, hand sanitizer. You really think about it, and that's really, a lot of it was coming from that. So it was just closed spaces, no sanitation, or lack of adequate sanitation, I would say. And that's going to be, that's why the smallpox and the other things, really all these things are, you know, the communicable diseases. So, you know, a lot of that stuff came from these, you know, all these people shoved in one place with very little room to move and to mobilize, and they get, you know, they just catch things from each other.
And you also have to remember that this was the first war that America had ever been in that was a total war. It was, the people think of the Civil War as somehow only a few areas were impacted. 70% of the battles occurred in Virginia. 70%.
Wow.
And so when you're thinking about this as a total war, people were displaced. The free blacks who were fleeing, as well as enslaved blacks, were fleeing to places out like Alexandria, or they were fleeing to Fort Monroe or Hampton or Norfolk. They were fleeing for their lives. They were fleeing not just to get freedom, but they were fleeing to survive, because this was the place where the military was. There was possible food, clothing, shelter, water, all of those things. And the military was trying to win a war. They were not trying to be a place where refugees were coming, and they were not trying to protect the refugees. They didn't have the resources or the preparation to prepare for all these people coming. In addition, you had all these soldiers who were there, who were dying. If you think of Virginia, you think of Hampton Roads, all the low-lying areas here. So if you have a lot of people in a camp, you don't have an opportunity for drainage, because the ground is low-lying. So there's nothing that's going to be flowing down. It's just going to be stagnant. And if you consider all the different plantations along the East Coast, that's where a lot of battles occurred, as they were going from one place to the next, because these plantations were usually on major routes going down. So if you go into the Black Belt and you're going down to I-40 and I-75, and all, those are where your major plantations were located. Those were the roads, and they were low-lying areas in many cases. And so the troops were trying to win battles, they were trying to survive, and sanitation was the last thing on their minds until it really started impacting the health and well-being of the soldiers. But then at the same time, the resources just were not there.
Okay. If you'd like to join our conversation, please give us a call at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. I want to ask our two historians a little bit about that particular time frame. And I want to know, you guys have done so much research on this. What was your particular aha moment? And I know you've probably had many, but that you would like to share with our listeners about things that you have uncovered during your research about this particular time period. Audrey, I want to start with you.
Well, one of the things that is important to me, and what I enjoy reading about and hearing about, is how so many of the contraband, when they're coming in, you know, when they're trying to flee, and whenever they get to where they're able to settle, the one thing that they're always stressing to everyone is the importance of education, the importance of, you know, they want to be free, but they also want to be educated. And you see that, and also the generosity of spirit within the contraband camps and by the contraband. We have one story that we include on our memorial, and we have a military record of who's buried in our cemetery, which has been very helpful to our city genealogist. And we have it's a really amazing document. It gives us the first and last name, the person buried, their age, what they died of, and where possible, where they died. But the person that we know the least about in this record, this one gentleman named Peter Washington, lost all of his family. They were all sold away from him, and his, four sons were serving as USCT. So when he's in Alexandria and he dies, he really has only one family member with him. And he had lost so much, but when he came to Alexandria, he made it a point to minister to the contraband. And Harriet Jacobs, in a letter, describes his funeral and how many people showed up and how moving it was. And she just says, you know, it's amazing that, you know, his family is scattered. He knows not where. But he really cared. I mean, he said, you know, when he first came to Alexandria that he thought he couldn't bear up under this burden. But the fact that he could be free, that others could be free, that he could help others, kept him going. And you see that also in Jacob's letters, where she's saying that contraband women, even if they have several children of their own, will take in an orphan child. So I think it's the generosity of spirit among people who have nothing and who have struggled for everything in their lives. I think that's what's so moving and so inspiring to me in the story.
Okay. Cassandra, your aha moment in your research.
I think we tend to overlook the fact that the Civil War was really the beginning of our modern period. With all the devastation, as Keith had said earlier, it opened the door for doctors for the first time in large numbers to begin working together and exchanging ideas and finding out what worked and what didn't work. And it really was the birth of our modern medical world. There were a lot of bad practices before. Some of them continued, like the use of mercury to cure quote unquote syphilis, sassafras tea, which contains an element that's poisonous, and a lot of people were using that on a regular basis to supposedly cure all kinds of things. And eventually we would see the development of something like that would keep us from having bacterial infections, prototypes to penicillin, but that wouldn't be until 1928, somewhere around there, that penicillin would be discovered. And so my aha moment was that this was the time period when Black doctors really came to the forefront. And when you consider the devastation, the extreme devastation, this was a time when African American men especially were waking up, having opportunities to come into their own, learning the field, because most of the doctors actually didn't go to medical school at that time. It would be by the 1890s that you would really start seeing more and more people going into medical school, and then there would be an adoption of a rule. Most of the others had been apprenticed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have these Black physicians who are coming into their own, some of them reaching officer status during the Civil War. And this would really birth the Black medical profession, and it would expand it. But had it not been for the Civil War, I'm not so sure that that would have happened.
Okay. I noticed that, and either Audrey, you or Cassandra can chime into this. I noticed that Sam, he was a free Black. He had worked, raised in a household with a physician, and had mm-hmm. learned his different techniques from there. It just seems like...
That was very common, by the way. You have, for example, a man named Thomas Bain, who escaped through the Underground Railroad from Norfolk in the 1850s, who became a dentist, but he was the apprentice to this dentist, and he would be sent out on house calls throughout the night when he was enslaved. And so he really learned his profession. A lot of Blacks learned that profession that way in the earlier years and became these physicians, these surgeons in some cases, later on.
You would think they would be welcoming that help, but it seemed like they were there. At least one of the scenes I remember watching as I was watching the first episode of the series, the Sam had saved somebody's life, but then when the actual surgeon came in, he kind of turned his back and, you know, let the nurse take the credit for it to keep from, I don't have no idea what would have happened to him. But I mean, he was there to volunteer and to help. And it was just very interesting and very compelling what had happened.
I'm looking at some of the thoughts. I mean, it's just really interesting. You know, and for those of you who don't know, Dr. Newby Alexander is actually my sister, so when she and I start getting into our little brigades of talking, pay us no mind. But you know, she shared with me something while we were during the interview about the rules for preserving the health of the soldier, and I'm cringing as I'm reading this as you hear what they thought the proper physiology was then and what it truly is and what we know it to be, such as. Says his spirits, which we know is alcohol, should only be issued to the men after unusual exertion, fatigue, or exposure, and on the discretion of the surgeon. So they're saying that you should give somebody alcohol to drink if they're dehydrated, which is actually the absolute wrong thing to do because actually alcohol makes you urinate. So if you're already dehydrated and you drink that, that's why half these people probably died. Says his water should always... should be always drank. I don't know what in the world that English was. I'm just reading it, guys. I want everybody to know I'm not, this is not my language. This is what's written here. But water should be always drank in moderation, especially when the body is heated. So they're actually telling you to drink less. They said excessive thirst, which follows violent exertion or loss of blood, is unnatural. I mean, I can't believe I'm flabbergasted reading this, and is not quenched by large and repeated, you know, consumption of water. So they're actually telling you don't drink water if you're dehydrated, and give them alcohol if they are.
Live and learn.
So I mean, just reading this, it really does bring to light. Now, fortunately, you know, we've come to the stage where we can see the changes, and as we learned, that was totally wrong. But this is a published, you know, article teaching people how they should be treating soldiers. So, you know, and it starts to make sense, the mortality rate and why, because again, we know, and again, to me, and I guess maybe because we learned physiology the way we did, a lot of this stuff is intuitive to me. So when I see things, it really makes sense. You think about it, you're dehydrated, that means your blood volume is low, the water part of your blood is less, so you drink more water, it's going to rehydrate that up. But they were thinking the exact opposite then. So they're almost creating their own misery. Not intentionally, looks like. They really think this is the way things should have been. But unfortunately, so we find out that's not the case. So
And that's such a good point. And you think about, this was in 1861 that they wrote it.
Right.
I haven't seen a report in 1865, but I'm sure that report is going to be very different.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's, that's why I said this was the beginnings of modern medicine, because all these theories that they had at the beginning of the Civil War changed dramatically, not because they had a few thousand people that they had to treat. They had millions of people that they had to treat within a space of 4 years. We were completely unprepared for that. America didn't even, for the most part, have hospitals. Hospitals were the place where you carry people to die, or you wanted them to be removed from the population. You quarantined them in a hospital. If you wanted to survive, you were at home. You weren't in a hospital, because hospitals were some of the most unsanitary places imaginable. After the Civil War, they started putting certain kinds of things into place. But it would take, what, about 40 years before hospitals were not seen as places of death.
Audrey, I want to ask you a quick question. I noticed that one of the families that's centered on in the drama is a Southern family who decided to stay, whereas they were talking about how their other friends left and abandoned their homes, and they decided to stay, and their Union soldiers walking through their home, and the Union soldiers have taken over the hospital that they owned as a hotel. How often did that happen?
There were quite a few families that stayed. There were some families who stayed and took the oath of allegiance. But the Green family, you'll see through the course of this season, there is a debate about will the father or won't the father sign the oath of allegiance. And it's interesting because there are diaries from Julia Wilbur, letters from Harriet Jacobs, and when Harriet Jacobs and Julia Wilbur are serving as aid workers in Alexandria, these two amazing women from very different backgrounds, Harriet Jacobs being a former slave, Julia Wilbur, an abolitionist from New England, one of the things they bonded over was the fact that, and how they became friends was the fact that Harriet Jacobs was treated so badly by a Confederate sympathizer. They were going around begging for blankets and clothes, any kind of clothing for the contraband and to aid them. And one Confederate sympathizer was just yelling at Jacobs and hurling horrible kinds of abuse. And Jacobs stood her ground, and it earned her the respect of Wilbur, who had been a little bit resentful of her position as an aid worker because she was slightly above Wilbur. And it was just, you see these interactions that will go on during the course of the war, and I think the show will show you how you'll see so many different communities interacting, not only contraband and free black, and but you'll also see the different, the Union sympathizers, the Confederate sympathizers. It's all going to be shown in Mercy Street, and we hope that if the public enjoys the show and a second season follows, that we'll have a chance to explore more of these stories, because as Cassandra was saying, I mean, the Civil War not only is the first time where we're looking at really the beginning of organized medicine, but we are still looking at how our country deals with race relations. There's so many things that occur as a result of this war that this country is still dealing with today. And I think you can draw certainly parallels, even with our current refugee crisis, to the contraband. There are so many parallels, so I think that there's an opportunity for the public to learn a lot, not only about Civil War medicine, but about families, about race, about war, about loyalties. So I think that this is an opportunity to have another dialogue about these important issues.
Okay, Cassandra, how did, we talked about blacks working as volunteers. Mm-hmm. How do you survive if you're, for example, if you're a contraband and you're working? How do you survive as a volunteer?
Well, that was the problem for a lot of black nurses. Many of them, though, were married to the soldiers. In fact, you had Susie King Taylor, who was connected to the first United States Colored Troops down in South Carolina. They were the South Carolina Volunteers, and so she married a man who's there, and he had rations. And sometimes they, as volunteers, they then could get rations that were given to the soldiers. A lot of the contraband, though, they would work cleaning clothes and doing other things for the soldiers, and so the soldiers would give them food and clothing or other things to help them survive. Most of the time, money was not really exchanged. It was a bartering system where, you know, the primary thing people needed and wanted is food. And the fact that you're like that means that you're going to have probably a high mortality rate, even among those who are there helping. Harriet Tubman, for example, in 1865, she was hired as the matron for the contraband hospital at Fort Monroe. She had actually visited that hospital and talked about the horrific conditions that were there before. And by the time she arrived, things had improved, but she put in place some procedures for, you know, how they're supposed to operate, because Clara Barton had pioneered that starting in 1862 with, you know, what should nurses do? What are the procedures they should follow in trying to take care of the patients? But, you know, you didn't have an American branch of the Red Cross until early 1880s, either 1880 or 1881. And so so they were just really starting to put some procedures and practices, best practices in place. They were constantly running out of bandages. They were constantly running out of anything, ether or anything that would help the patients. And we can forget any kind of real medicines. It was folk medicine that people used. And that's why I brought up the issue of sassafras tea. You know, people were using that quite often. And Susie King Taylor talked in her book about how she used that to help treat dysentery. And Harriet Tubman talked about home remedies that she had using geraniums and other things that, and water lilies that she would boil down to. And I'm sure it was more like a diuretic to just get people to expel all that out of their system. But really, I think it was really whether or not they had the constitution to survive, more so than the treatment that was actually given to them. I'll leave that for you to.
I think that's obvious, I tell you.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left in the conversation, believe it or not, has gone pretty quickly. But Audrey, your final thoughts?
I just, of course, encourage everyone to look at Mercy Street, to delve more into Civil War history, to the history of African Americans. It's so rich. There's no one story. We encompass so many stories in so many parts of American history. And as a descendant of a contraband from Fortress Monroe, William Roscoe Davis, I have been proud to work on contrabands as a story in Alexandria, and proud to have it parallel not only my family history but my work history, and now seeing it as part of Mercy Street, the contraband history, which I think will enlighten people about an area of history that many people don't know about.
Okay, we got about a minute left.
I would echo Audrey's sentiments exactly, because too often we get a very singular view of that time period, often excluding African Americans from involvement in all of this. And Mercy Street at least opens the door for that. There's a much bigger story to tell, but it's at least the beginning.
Wonderful. Keith?
Well, the only thing I would say is just be glad that we live in the time we do now with what we know about medicine. Because I tell you, if I didn't know Mary Shelley didn't write Frankenstein prior to the Civil War, I think Mary Shelley would have got the idea for her Frankenstein creature from some of the aftermath of the Civil War veterans. Because I tell you, that was probably Cousin Fred. So,
well, with that, we will say goodbye. Keith, thank you so much, as always, for being here with us. Cassandra, thank you so much. And Audrey Davis, director of the Alexandria Black History Museum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, local history comes to life next week at Norfolk's historic Wells Theater with the Virginia Stage Company's production of The Hampton Years. Now, here's a behind-the-scenes peek at this true story of Hampton Institute art teachers and their students struggling to develop their talents at a time when society's expectations for African-American artists weren't always welcoming. It was the 1940s. The nation was on the verge of World War II, and at Hampton Institute, now Hampton University, a movement was underway that would change the art world forever. It all begins with Victor Lowenfeld, a brilliant artist, thinker, and teacher who fled Austria when the Nazis invaded. He and his young family have made their new home in the segregated South. Adam Greer plays Victor.
My character was originally hired as the Hampton Institute at the time was a trade school, to be a psychologist, and he established the art department at the school, and we see a little bit of that kind of political play with the president of the university, because he's trying to establish an art program, and then the president's constantly telling him the focus needs to be on arts education. They have to learn to teach. They need to leave here able to work.
They're Negroes. You and I both know they don't have the luxury to rely on talent.
The artist doesn't create for luxury. Create because life demands it.
But if you tell them that they can be artists, they'll hate you when the world tells them they can't.
But Victor recognizes the talent in his young students and isn't about to take no for an answer.
How is your other painting coming along?
Dying soldier. I haven't had a lot of time to work on it.
Well, you need to make time. I am putting together a young Negro art exhibit for the Young Persons Gallery at the MoMA. We have to think about which pieces of yours to showcase.
Wait, what? My work is going to be in New York? Are you serious?
The Dying Soldier should be the piece de resistance. It's your best work so far.
Victor's ally in the fight to groom professional artists and not art teachers is Elizabeth Catlett, a prominent artist who is played by Chandra Thomas.
She is passionate about art, most especially using art to speak to the experience of being of African descent in this country, and especially from the perspective of women.
Elizabeth is determined to teach more than art lessons. She wants Victor to understand that African Americans are judged much differently than their white counterparts.
Critics can be harsh, especially to new work, and even more so to the work of Negro artists. They might not understand what he's trying to do, and if they don't, they won't be afraid to say so. There's more at stake for him, for all of these students, because of the color of their skin.
All of a sudden, you have these artists who are speaking to their culture and to their time. Artists who are representing their thoughts, their fears, their commentary on the society, rather than trying to fit in and being technically great painters. It was, how do you use your experience in this country to create change? By setting it in this time, I think it reminds us not how far we've come, but how far we still have to go.
These artists had such huge influential careers and are taught in, you know, art schools around the world. And for us to not have access to that knowledge of them just really speaks to, you know, again, this sort of trend of allowing other people to define our stories.
Not only will the audience learn about the amazing artists that Hampton Institute produced, but they'll get to see works from then and now. Virginia Stage Company Marketing Associate Carlin Becker explains.
The plan is to do two displays where we'll have one that's going to be artwork from the characters or the real people in the play, and then we'll do another display that's artwork by current Hampton University students. So that's going to be, we're working on putting that up in our lobby and side lobby of the theater.
Audiences will quickly discover that the Hampton Years has many layers. While the students are beginning their trek to put their historic mark on the art world, Victor is learning a lesson all his own.
He's come from a society where he's been excluded, where he's been persecuted, where they've been mass murdered. So he immediately assumes that we're all in this together. What's really an interesting lesson in this play is, no matter how on board you think you are, you can't fully understand this, even though you came from a similar experience, an awful experience. It's not the same experience.
I know what is at stake.
No, you don't. You can't possibly know. This isn't your world, Doc.
Elizabeth, we have a chance to do something no other school has done, and I have to take it. I believe in these students. I believe in their talent.
As do I.
Then help me.
The Hampton Years begins with three preview performances, January 19th through the 21st. The official opening is January 22nd. The production will continue through February 7th. Well, that's our show for today. A program note, we will broadcast and webcast a very special edition of Another View next Tuesday, January 19th at 1 p.m. in partnership with Colonial Williamsburg. We will bring you an uplifting hour of conversation about the role of religion in freedom movements and the common bonds that the different faiths share. You'll learn the history of the historic First Baptist Church in Williamsburg and find out the significance of ringing the church bell, which has been silent for almost 60 years. The show is called Let Freedom Ring. You can hear it on 89.5 WHRV-FM at 1 p.m., or you can stream it at letfreedomringchallenge.org or at whro.org. If you'd like to hear today's show again, please visit our website at anotherviewradio.org and download the podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook, or you can send me a tweet at godly_Lisa or tweet Barbara at Barbara Ham Lee. Our theme music was composed and performed by Jay Sennett. Producer Morgan Chase, thank you so kindly agreeing to fill in for me today. Our audio engineer is Victor Bowen. I'm Lisa Godley. Barbara, we are sending you our love. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and let's get together again next Friday at noon for another view.